For the week of November 6th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 125, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
In New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
Whoa, oh, Karen! Hello, it's old home week.
Yes, it is. But Sperling, I'm so glad to know some things haven't changed. You always start off with, this is the week of such and such, right?
Yes. Yes. Well, you know, we try to keep some consistency to the show. Now, for those of you who are joining us for the first time or who haven't been with us very long, Karen used to be one of the hosts of Showbiz Sandbox, and now she's gone off to a much more lucrative career in social media marketing.
And she comes back occasionally to check in and make sure we're keeping up.
Yes, that we haven't switched to, like, I don't know, news about animals or some other industry.
Well, actually, this when you know I knew I was going to come back, it forced me to really like stay on top of the entertainment news. I was like, oh no, what the hell's been going on in entertainment?
What, Kim Kardashian's getting divorced? I didn't even know she was married.
Okay, somebody, because I actually do, you know, a social media channel that's for entertainment, so I sort of do know what's going on. But one of the people that I talk to on a regular basis is like, what, Kim Kardashian is getting divorced? And this was like a week after it happened. Like, where have you been?
Justin Bieber's a father?
Alleged father.
Alleged father. Yeah, you know, we don't cover any of that news. But on today's show, we will be talking about IPTV. Specifically, we're going to be talking about Google's plans to get into the cable television business and compete directly with Karen and her clients.
I know. I read that. I was like,
Good luck with that.
Well, meanwhile, Louis C.K., the comedian, he's given up on cable entirely. He's called Time Warner, Comcast, all of me, and he's not even going with satellite. He'll broadcast his next comedy concert directly to fans via the internet. And if that weren't enough, radio broadcasters are facing struggles of their own, and we'll tell you how one of the industry's biggest companies shocked the music world over the past 2 weeks by firing all of their local DJs. During Inside Baseball, we'll discuss the complicated and, I don't know, confusing machinations of how musicians' digital performance royalties are at risk. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop and end with some correspondence from listeners. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Yes, and we cover the box office around the world. The number one movie worldwide is Puss in Boots, which grossed $48 million in the U.S. and four markets internationally, including Russia, which was the big place where it made money overseas. Puss in Boots has now grossed $114 million worldwide. It had a great holdover last week, so there's more to say about this once we go through the numbers. The number two film around the world worldwide is The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn, or if you live in France, The Adventures of Tintin. It grossed $40.8 million. It's at $125 million and counting. It opens in the U.S. in December. At number three worldwide is Tower Heist, which grossed $34.6 million. At number four is In Time, the Justin Timberlake movie. That grossed another $24.3 million. It's at $62 million and counting. At number five is Paranormal Activity 3, another $22.6 million, even though it's Halloween is over. That's at $172 million worldwide and counting. At number six is Real Steel, starring Hugh Jackman, who's doing a lot better on Broadway than he is at the movies. His film grossed $14.1 million. It's at $206 million worldwide, so it's not an embarrassment, but not nearly the big hit he and Universal were hoping for.
Yeah, I would have thought that movie would have done much better. And by the way, it's DreamWorks. Universal's, you know, doing the distribution, but DreamWorks is the one that actually produced that film.
That's right. At number seven, a movie I'm sorry I haven't seen yet, A Very Harold and Kumar 3D Christmas, which grows $13 million worldwide, basically in North America only. At number eight is Intouchables, a French film, which had a huge opening in France. It grossed $12.5 million. It's a comedy about a super rich quadriplegic and the ex-con immigrant who is his caretaker.
So it's a broad comedy then.
It is. It is a comedy. Needless to say, the Weinsteins have already bought it for the U.S. At number nine is Rise of the Planet Apes with $7.4 million. It's at $470 million and counting. At number 10, the James Bond spoof, Johnny English Reborn, with another $7.3 million. It's about to hit $150 million worldwide. And number 11, The Three Musketeers, which grossed $5.8 million. It's made almost no money in the U.S., but overseas it's done quite well. It's at $113 million and counting. So those are the movies at the box office. Puss in Boots is the big story, obviously.
Well, it's the big story, what? Because it actually managed to thwart Eddie Murphy, who was trying to become the number one box office draw again with Tower Heist?
I don't know if you can call Tower Heist Eddie Murphy's movie per se. It's really Ben Stiller's movie. I saw it, and Eddie Murphy's the best thing in it, but it's not a very good movie.
So you wouldn't pay $60 to watch it at home as Universal?
No, right, isn't that interesting? I would have been curious to know how that would have worked.
Yeah, so you didn't see Harold and Kumar, I take it?
I didn't. But I've seen a lot of movies lately, you guys. Footloose, awesome. Why is nobody seeing this movie?
I don't know. I mean, it's only made $54 million worldwide. I think maybe we should write a note to Hollywood, memo to Hollywood, please stop remaking 80s, you know,
no,
hits.
We should not do that. We should do like I did and put on the Footloose page and say, "Dear Paramount, why did you fuck up the marketing for this movie?"
what could they have done differently?
You know, it's a fun movie, and they should have marketed it to people my age who remember the original, and it makes you giggle. It makes you want to get up and dance. I know that sounds really corny, but that's totally what it does. It's an homage to the original movie, and they marketed it like it was like Step Up 5.
Stern drama. Yeah, yeah.
And it's not like that at all.
Do you think it's a shame that they didn't have Zac Efron in that role?
No, no, no. I think Kenny Wormald is actually pretty good in it.
Kenny who?
He was a nobody. He was a backup dancer for Justin Timberlake. And I believe he was set to be the stunt dancer, the backup dancer. You know what I mean?
And then when Zac Efron
real dancer. And then when Zac Efron dropped out and they kept reading more people for it, they asked him to read, or he asked if he could read, and they just really liked him.
Well, Puss in Boots is the big news, not because it trumps Tower Heist.
Although it did in the US.
It did, but because it was the number one movie and almost dropped nothing. It held very strongly from the Halloween weekend. It dropped just 3.1%, which is a terrific hold for any film, especially a movie that's open that wide. There was some silly comment when it opened on Halloween. Halloween is a very low weekend for movie box office. It was the highest grossing Halloween opening of all time. And yet some moronic analyst said, "Oh, it's a terrible opening. It's way lower than it should have been, blah, blah, blah." And it's like, no. Look historically at Halloween. People don't go to the movies on Halloween. It did great. It got good reviews. We predicted it would have a good hold. It had a great hold. So now it's poised, like a lot of DreamWorks movies, to make a ton more money overseas. And the analysts should swallow what they say and apologize. I mean, the stock of DreamWorks dropped 8% because of the opening weekend, which was crazy.
What, because of that one analyst said something?
Well, because people go, "Oh, look, it's not, you know, it's like half of what Shrek opens at." It's like, well, it's not a Shrek film. It's a spinoff. And it opened in Halloween. And there was a terrible nor'easter that out of the first snowstorm of its like since the Civil War. So all these things depressed the box office. So, you know, show a little perspective.
But can we give a good giggle for the fact that people always come up with these like really random like ways of measuring things? Like, it's the best Halloween opening ever. Or it's the best 2 weeks after Halloween opening ever for comedy.
Exactly, but at least it's a major holiday, and we know it's a very depressed time for the movies. People don't go to the movies on Halloween. They go out trick-or-treating, even if it's on a Monday. And so you should, you know, it's like Moneyball, the baseball movie. There's, "Oh, it's not doing that well." It's the third highest grossing baseball movie of all time. It's just past $70 million. If it hits $75 million, it will be the second biggest baseball movie of all time. So, you know, put it in perspective.
Well, putting things in perspective, and I don't want to go down the road of whether the motion picture industry is doing well or not as a whole, but theatrically
doing great. There's no debate. It's poised to have perhaps the second biggest year of all time. It's doing wonderful. Worldwide, it's poised to have its best year internationally of all time. It looks poised to pass the $12 billion that we matched last year and be the highest grossing overseas year of all time. And it's very likely going to be the second highest year in U.S. history, beaten only by the year of Avatar. Sounds pretty good to me.
I still think TV's better.
What I'm referring to is North American grosses only, okay? And North American, I'm going to narrow it down even more and say North American theatrical grosses only. I thought this was interesting, and it's kind of hard to compare these because I was reading, you know, everybody's trying to compare all these openings to other openings. So they looked at Tower Heist, and then said, okay, Ben Stiller starred in that. Meet the Parents opened to $28.6 million. Of course, it opened, you know, umpteen years ago. Starsky and Hutch opened to $28.1 million. And they're comparing it to the $25 million that Tower Heist opened to. And what's interesting about that is you have fewer people attending films. And it's a trend that is, you know, somewhat alarming because, of course, you know, you want that theatrical gross to stay up. Maybe they'll make up the money somewhere else, whether it be DVD or ancillary markets. But in the U.S., I'm not talking about internationally, because you're absolutely right, Michael, the international grosses are going through the roof. Why? Because of the multiplexing of the rest of the world. So you have India, Russia, Brazil, all of these places are building their multiplexes, and they're underscreened. They're slowly putting more theaters in place. And of course, grosses are going to go up. But it's interesting to see that even though population increases in the U.S., that the trend of seeing movies, the trend is going down rather than...
No, it is not. Why are you saying that? I've told you this 100 times. Movie ticket sales have increased every decade since the 70s. In the modern era, ticket sales are keeping pace with population. They're growing as a pure number of how many tickets are sold. They're keeping a pace with population despite the fact that people also spend tens of billions of dollars buying movies on DVD, watching them on video on demand, and watching them on streaming, have cable with tons of movies, channels available to them. Plus, of course, the competition
again, I'm
of
only
the internet and video games. Theatrical ticket sales are up. They are up.
Okay,
they're keeping pace
with
population.
I'm going to play referee here, guys. It's so great to know nothing's changed. You guys always argue about this. But
it's not an argument.
Let's cut to the chase here, though. Well, let's cut to the chase here. Unless you work in the business, who cares?
Well, why is Tower Heist did not have a great opening? Because it's not a great film. It got
bad
reviews.
Yeah, it's got bad word of mouth. It's a Netflix. It's not something you spend your money on.
Right. And at $25.1 million, which is how much it made, $25.1 million, it had fewer people attend it than the 1996 opening of The Nutty Professor, which made $25.4 million. And now you adjust that for inflation.
All the ticket prices have gone up.
Right.
That's true.
Yeah. And so fewer people.
And some movies charge more for tickets because they're in 3D. Okay.
Yeah. Well, speaking
of charging. Doesn't matter. It means nothing. It doesn't mean that ticket sales overall are down. That's not true. It means if you want to sell the same number of tickets as a movie 20 years ago, you're going to make a lot more money. If you sell 400,000 tickets today, you'll make more money than if you sold 400,000 tickets 20 years ago. Of course.
Right. And so you're saying that in 1996...
Ticket sales today are higher. The ticket sales in the 2000s were higher than in the 90s. They sold more tickets at the box office in the 2000s than they did in the 90s. In the 90s, they sold more tickets than the 80s.
But wait a second. We just said the opening of The Nutty Professor had more people attend it in 1996.
Well, why are we even comparing it to
The Nutty Professor? What are you talking about? Why are you confused about it? Of course more people attended it because they grossed $25 million, which means they sold... Who knows? Let's make it up. 300,000 tickets. If you sold 300,000 tickets today, since ticket prices are higher, you'd make more money and your gross would be higher.
Why are we comparing it to The Nutty Professor?
Yeah.
Well, it's an Eddie Murphy film.
But Tower Heist is not an Eddie Murphy film. It's an ensemble.
Right. Well, I'm also just going based on what, you know,
yes,
every other.
If you had the same gross today as you did 20 years ago, that means you sold fewer tickets. That's absolutely true. Of course. But
you know,
overall,
social media has changed the way people watch movies, because now that's why we're all measuring Friday night box office instead of just on Sunday,
yeah.
Because that says so much. The drop off from Friday night box office for the rest of the weekend says so much. I mean, that's what's word of mouth right there. Tower Heist did not do well because Tower Heist is not a very good movie.
Well, what about Harold and Kumar? I guess it came in number three here in the U.S., and 95% of its gross came from 3D ticket sales. That's pretty impressive.
Can you tell me how many screens were 3D and 2D? I couldn't find it in 2D.
At 2,550 locations, I don't know how many screens that is. I couldn't tell you.
But Harold and Kumar is a franchise. I mean, that's the type of movie that even if word of mouth was bad, the drop-off probably wouldn't be that sharp because... It almost doesn't matter. It's Harold and Kumar. It's like visiting old friends. They don't care.
Right.
If it's bad.
He was just touting the fact that it sold a bunch of tickets in 3D. Like the number of people going to see movies in 3D has been sort of going down.
I didn't even know
people can avoid it. Dude.
Yeah, it's in 3D, and 3D, you know, has taken both a beating and I guess has been praised by two very important people over the past week. Ron Meyer called it. You know, he's the head of Universal, the chairman of Universal. I worked with him at Creative Artists Agency back in the day, but he bashed it. He said it was a way for really awful movies to try and find an audience.
I agree.
But at the same time, Martin Scorsese gave a rousing endorsement to, according to the LA Times, to 3D and says that holograms will be next.
Well, doesn't he have a movie coming out in 3D?
Yeah.
Duh, exactly.
Duh.
And it looks terrible. in 3D.
Yeah, it looks
the trailer
awful.
Looks awful. The movie looks awful. God bless him. He's made good movies and bad movies like everybody. But a guy with his first movie in 3D saying 3D is really cool, it's not exactly a shocker.
Yeah, he says, as I sit here now, I see you in 3D. So why belittle that part of our experience?
We belittle it because it's a pain to watch with 3D glasses on.
Right.
And his movie will not do well because it's a good or a bad movie, not because it's in 3D.
So you don't think it's going to be up for an Oscar?
Hell
oh, it may be some technical award, but I doubt it. It looks very, very poor.
Okay. Well, you know, just very briefly, speaking of Oscars,
that was a segue.
Yes. This past week, Gil Cates died at the age of 77. And if you don't know who Gil Cates is, he is the producer and director of the... He was the producer and director of the Oscars for 14 telecasts, starting, I think.
He's almost always nominated for having produced, directed the previous year's Oscars.
That's
so
right.
Everybody, you recognize him because it always goes to the sound booth or the producer's booth or wherever the hell he is. And he always waves to the camera. So it's like, you look at a picture of him and you're like, I know that guy.
And he was
that's
just
the Emmy guy.
Yeah, I mean, he was credited with bringing Billy Crystal and Steve Martin to the telecast as hosts. He's an incredibly nice guy. I knew him from, believe it or not, the Geffen Playhouse, which is kind of a regional off-Broadway theater here in Los Angeles, but he was its artistic director, and they named the theater after him, one of the main theaters, and I would always see him there and always get to talk to him there, and it was just so weird that this guy who was really kind of a legend in this business was just kind of hanging out at the Geffen Playhouse.
Well, that was his baby, wasn't it?
It was, yes, it was.
Yeah, I mean, he was a driving force behind it. It wasn't that he just was hanging out there. It was his... That was his thing.
Yes. Well, of course. Yeah.
So I guess his last Oscars that he did was 2008.
Yes.
But he was, you know, he's a legend around forever. God bless him.
How did he die?
Old age. He's 77.
He's 77 and they found
not
him.
Not that old.
Having, no, I know.
Well, they found him having collapsed in the UCLA, in a UCLA parking lot. And I guess he had heart trouble to begin with and they couldn't revive him. So unfortunately, Gil Dates passed away at the age of 77.
Well, it's sort of like Andy Rooney. When you know he stopped doing the 60 Minutes, you figured his time wasn't long. It's Steve Jobs. Gil Cates stops doing the Oscars. Clearly, he must be at an age where he's feeling a little infirm or he'd just keep going.
Yeah. Well, and of course, Andy Rooney passed away, too. The columnist, if you will.
Commentator.
Commentator.
Crotchety commentator.
Curmudgeonly, I like to say.
You know what I don't like?
Animated films.
Actually, I love animated films. In fact, this year, I can love 18 animated films, all of which are eligible for Oscars.
Yeah, you know, they have a short list of 18 animated films that are eligible for this year's Oscar, which will be given out in early 2012. It's a lot of movies, so they'll probably expand the list to 5 films rather than just 3. But it's going to be a very tight year. I mean, the locks are clearly Puss in Boots, which I think is the film to beat, and The Adventures of Tintin. The Steven Spielberg film, which is also considered an animated film, that leaves 3 slots for a lot of movies. There's Kung Fu Panda 2. Rio was a big hit early in the year. Rango has Johnny Depp. And I know that Hollywood people love it because of its playing with genres.
Oh, it was Cars. A lot of fun, that movie. But kids, it was not for kids. Kids did not like
That's
it
right.
at all.
It's okay. It can still win. Cars 2, Winnie the Pooh. Arthur Christmas, you know, there's a lot of films that will be fighting for those last 3 slots.
Arthur Christmas is a fun movie.
Really?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. But yeah, 18 films, I mean, that just goes to show you how technology, I mean, it used to take 3-4 years to make one of these films, and now it's just taking off.
And, you know, the big thing I think is that one of the real surprises could be not only will Pixar not win the animated Oscar, it may not even be nominated. There are so many good movies like Kung Fu Panda 2 and Rio and Winnie the Pooh and, oh, I forgot Happy Feet 2. That's the big ringer. Happy Feet, the original, won the Oscar for Best Animated Film. I really like George Miller. That's going to be a big contender as well. Cars 2 may not even be nominated. So that will end a whole bunch of streaks. First of all, of course, it's the first Pixar film to get really bad reviews, though Cars came close. It's going to be it could be the first Pixar film not to get nominated for Best Animated Film Oscar, and it could end the four in a row run that Pixar has had. They've won Best Animated Film Oscar 4 years in a row with Ratatouille, WALL-E, Up, and Toy Story 3.
Yeah, and I can tell Karen couldn't care less about any of these.
You know how I feel about cartoons.
Well, Karen, how do you feel about TV?
Movies.
Are you watching The X Factor?
No, I'm not watching it.
Oh, dear. Well, have you picked up any fall television shows?
Yeah.
What are you watching?
Oh my gosh, let's think. Okay. In terms of this new shows or
Yeah, basically the new shows. Which ones you've picked up an attitude
I'm
list?
watching Two Broke Girls, but put me in that camp of people who thought the pilot was darling and now it completely sucks.
Well, then you must be a woman because watching I don't know her name, Kat
Kat
Denning.
Dennings.
Oh, she is great.
She's really great and she deserves a better show. In fact, I think both the actresses are pretty good in it. They deserve better material. The show is like, it's a throwback to like 70s. It's terrible.
I would love to see one of those episodes, a Two Broke Girls episode, not mention genitalia once.
Yeah, I know.
Keep dreaming.
Yeah.
I know. I'm watching Heart of Dixie too, which I think is really cute.
And I tried it, but I'm not going to watch it
It's totally
regularly.
a girl thing, I think. I discovered a new show that I absolutely love, Strike Back on Cinemax.
Never heard of it.
It was so good. If you have Cinemax, you got to watch it.
Well, and of course, it's probably got, lots of nudity because it is on Cinemax.
It does have
There you
nudity,
go. Yeah.
but
Cool.
guys get nude too. No frontal, unfortunately.
And I have to tell you, X Factor was boring, but the cast, the top 11 people that they have, there are four or five really good acts. They're far better than the last three or four seasons of American Idol. It's a very strong performers, I think, in that show. It's worth checking out again.
I think it's on at the same time as Revenge. Is it on at the same time as Revenge?
DVR, baby.
Yeah, I know.
But how do you get your television? Do you get it through a cable system, satellite?
Tinfoil hat is how Karen gets her cable or her
Yeah.
television.
I usually cable, but now I have Amazon Prime and Hulu Plus, so I do a lot of watching TV online too.
Oh,
Oh, wow.
do you not have cable?
I have cable.
Oh, you have cable too. I see. Okay.
Well, now if Google were to knock on your door and say, "Hey, we know you're with well, in LA it would be Time Warner. But how about like switching to us because we are now a cable company. What would you do? Would you want to do that? Would you decide to stick with Time Warner or would you jump over to Google?"
I think I would probably say to Google that they should stick to what they know best, which is search.
Right. Well, a lot of people are saying that, and Google last week announced that they didn't really announce it so much as there are rumors going around that they would like to add video and phone service to this experiment they're trying in Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas, where they are rolling out high-speed fiber for internet service. And that's kind of understandable because, of course, they are an internet search company. They want more people on the internet to do more searches and thus see more ads. But I guess they've been talking to some TV channels, TV networks, and studios about trying to add video to the package.
Like, duh, they want to get a piece of the pie. Everybody wants to do that. Apple wants to develop an Apple television set. Everybody wants to be the box that controls where and how you access your television programming and mix in online as well. Of course, Google wants to do it, but do they have any plan or idea that would make them smarter and better than everybody else? Not that I can tell.
No, it doesn't seem like that at all.
And they have no experience of building tech toys of any sort, do they?
Well, the Nexus phone, except they really just farm that out. They don't build that.
Yeah, no, they don't have a very good track record when it comes to hardware.
No, look at the. I mean, they didn't even build Google TV, which was Linksys, I think, built that, and that was a real failure.
Yeah, and so is Apple TV, which, by the way, I have, and it sucks. I mean, I've never seen a worse UI. Whoa, wow.
Really?
Oh my God, it's horrible.
Wow. Okay. I haven't played around with the new version that much, but I'll have to see if I can get my hands on a demo unit. But I think really, Michael, you were going to say something about Google's ability to build hardware.
Yeah, well, let's see how they do providing internet service. I mean, this is a new area for them as well. So, walk before you can run.
Right. Well, a lot of people were saying, look, you know what? You tried to be a phone manufacturer and you thought you could do it without any storefront and no customer service. That didn't work out too well for you. You found out, yes, you do need to actually have your phone in stores. People aren't going to buy it just online. And it costs a lot of money to roll out a cable network or a satellite network. Fios cost Verizon $23 billion to build out, and it wasn't successful. They've actually stopped rolling it out. And maintaining a cable TV infrastructure is not the same thing as you mentioned, Karen. It's not the same thing as search at all. It's a lot harder, and the margins are horrible.
I mean, they're very thin.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes. By horrible, I mean you can lose your shirt very quickly.
But
Besides,
having said all of that, I do like the idea that somebody is going
competing.
It's providing some competition for the cable companies, because I do find it very troubling that, you know, the cable companies have a monopoly in their areas.
Yes, I agree. And I think that monopoly is being challenged in a way, because you have all of these things, like you just said, Amazon Prime, Hulu Plus, Netflix. So people are beginning to realize, I don't need my cable company. I watch three channels. So I'll just...
except that you oftentimes do need to be a subscriber to a cable company in order to be able to watch some of that stuff online.
Right. Well, that's true.
There's the rub. I can't even subscribe to the New York Yankees online unless I own it on cable. Because I'm in the New York metro area, they won't let me pay $50, $70 a year what they would charge someone in Oklahoma to get Yankee games on their laptop. I can't do it because I'm in this area. I have to buy it via cable. And then they still won't let you do it. They still won't let you.
And you can't a la carte it, which really is
right
annoying.
Well, and I think that's probably going to, in the next 10 to 15 years, I think that will start to happen. People will, they'll have these broad packages that are somewhat a la carte, because otherwise cable will just not be able to compete.
Well, assuming somebody has a chance to compete. I'm in New York. I can choose between Vios, Time Warner Cable, and I suppose DirecTV. I've had huge problems with my DVR. I just had the cable guy here. I was actually seriously debating, you know, switching to not have cable at all. You know, what if I just went and got stuff online? What if I bought Amazon Prime? What if I bought Netflix? What if I did all this? The problem
was, I have
all of
that, you guys. I have all of it. And let me tell you, it's really worth it.
Yeah, except that I can't get New York Yankee games, literally. I can't get American Idol and X Factor
shows.
You know, there's live stuff you just can't get.
Yeah, and there was, speaking of social media and Karen, not that we were speaking about social media or Karen, but I read something somewhere. How's that for descriptive? Over the last week, about how people are watching live television now because they don't like the spoilers coming over Twitter. So specifically with sports, the television has really turned into a sports delivery device. And people are watching it live because if they're on Twitter or on Facebook or on some other social network, mm-hmm. it's going to be ruined for them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you can't even look at your text messages.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But who needs
you
cable?
You can't go online. I mean, you can't look at any news sites.
My emails pop up and tell me who was eliminated from X Factor, or I get a text message or the New York Times tells me who won the Alabama-LSU game. You got to be careful.
Some outlets are becoming a little smarter, and they'll say something like, you know, winner is chosen or something like that, so you actually have an option.
Right.
I'm assuming one of those people is not the Hollywood Reporter, since they seem to, or the LA Times.
Hollywood Reporter has actually gotten better about it.
Okay. Well, just to finish up on the whole Google front, I kind of like what Sanford Bernstein analysts had to say about it. They said that it's an R&D experiment for Google, and that it helps them get into the public policy debate over faster broadband and television online. And they said it's just going to be like a big, giant laboratory for Google. And I'd have to kind of agree with that.
And and you know what? More power to them. Because I like the fact that they're at least trying to compete. They want to do something new and different. I think they're going to lose a lot of money. But I do think that they will probably learn a lot from it. And somebody needs to take this step.
That's right. Well, you know, somebody is taking another step. And that's Louis C.K. He's saying, you know what? I don't want cable. I don't want satellite. I'm going to take my next comedy concert and just post it online.
Is he going to give it away for free?
No, he's going to charge $5 for it.
Good for him.
Yeah, I mean, why not? I mean, he said, you know, it used to be really exciting to have an HBO special. Now HBO doesn't do a lot of comedy specials anymore unless you're on their network. You know, Comedy Central has 8 gazillion comedy specials on all the time, but they censor all the curse words and, you know, they're really short. You know, so they cut all the good stuff out. You know, he's on FX with his show Louie, which is doing pretty well for FX. You'd think they might want it, but he just finally looked around.
Yeah, I thought that was weird.
What's, yeah.
I would have thought FX might have done something.
What do you, you mean like you thought it was weird that Louis C.K. did not take his comedy special to FX?
To FX, yeah.
Well, they're not really in that business. They're in the
They don't do one-off specials too much. Yeah, but they're in the business of promoting their stars, so I agree with Karen.
I thought it was very interesting that what he relayed about Showtime and HBO. He said that Showtime was really nice, but they don't really push stuff. They just kind of stick it on and hope that it does well. And, you know, he did mention that Comedy Central would, you know, they cut out all the cursing. But with HBO, they said, you know, even though they still do specials, that he didn't have a scripted show on their network. So they didn't really want to push him in that way. They felt, well, why give you publicity when you're going to go on to FX and do your scripted show there?
That's right. Coming next month, the comedy stylings of Steve Buscemi.
Actually, that God. Could... You know,
he's so awful in that show. I think he's the worst thing about Boardwalk Empire.
Really?
Yes. I realize we're not talking about Boardwalk Empire, but wow, to my opinion, whoa, what a total miscast. Anyway, we can talk about that some other time.
Well, that's cool. So he's going to charge about $5 per person, right?
Yes. I mean, would you guys buy this for $5?
If I was a Louis C.K. fan, yeah, I would.
And what about you, Michael?
Yeah, I'm not a particular fan, so I wouldn't. But I think it could work for his fans. You know, you can watch it with a couple friends. $5 is a lot better than 60 for Tower Heist.
Well, that's true. But, you know, here's the thing. If you were going to cut the cord and start buying programming a la carte, $5 is a lot to pay. You'd be able to watch, what, you know, you figure 20 shows or 20 pieces of content.
Well, this isn't competing with your cable subscription. This is saying, I'm at the Beacon Theater in New York. I've got a special. You can't see it anywhere else. If you want to watch it, $5. It's better, cheaper than a ticket to the show.
Okay, fair enough.
And you know what? Your local DJ could tell you all about the show and give away free tickets. Those used to be the days when your local DJ would say, hey, there's a show down at the local arena. You want 2 free tickets? Call in. Be calling number 7. Remember when that used to happen?
I'm so glad our segues are still subtle.
Yes, they're subtle like a hammer to the head. I guess, Michael, you're moving us along into this. I find this a fascinating story about...
Depressing.
It is depressing. A Clear Channel has cut most of their on-air talent across the country. They have basically said, we will do this from a central spot in New York, and we're going to program it that way too. We're going to program it through focus groups. That means the playlists will be even more homogenous than they already are.
That's not possible.
Well, come on. They could cut it down from 6 songs to 4 songs.
Right. It's very depressing. I mean, it's basically radio will be national.
That's right. I mean,
there's no local radio. They'll drop in a computerized voice to tell you what your weather is, but there'll be no local DJ in your local area. They'll never be playing local bands. They'll never be part of your community. They won't show up at your local, you know, grocery store to cut a ribbon or bring people out to the car dealership where some new cars are on sale and they're going to make a great deal. It's just, I mean, that seems sort of silly, but that presence and the talent and those people who love music and would champion artists that they loved regionally and locally, that's all gone for good.
Yeah, when was the last time a DJ actually did that? I know I'm going to be vilified for saying this, but I really don't care that they fire DJs. I find DJs so annoying. I mean, I love Jack FM because there's no DJs. I realize that makes me so white bread.
Oh, I hate Jack FM.
That makes me so white bread. I'm very aware of this. But, you know, I mean, on some level, it's sad because I remember when Ryan Seacrest was a DJ. I remember when Carson Daly was a DJ. It was a really good one. But, you know, I also remember, you know, Danny Bonaducci, and he had this horrible sidekick about 5 years ago when he was on, I think, 98.7. And Danny Bonaducci is actually a pretty good DJ, but he had this annoying, just vapid sidekick. I don't need that.
Well, I think that you're right, Karen. For the most part, DJs, the local DJs, were being handed playlists. They were not picking their
playlists.
Yeah,
I don't remember anybody introducing me to local music.
No, and Clear Channel, just for those who are outside the country and don't know, they own 850 radio stations and have about 12,000 employees, although I guess a few less after last week. So they are the largest radio station owner in the country, if not the world.
I mean, but K-Rock is a great example of a really great station. It's in Los Angeles that used to really be a champion of music. I mean, they have a long history of championing new artists and breaking them. Maybe you thought they were just big everywhere because they became big, but K-Rock was a station that really had a real distinctive presence and that did have DJs who did champion music. And, you know, that didn't happen where I grew up in Florida, but it happened in other parts of the country and it's gone for good. It's sort of like losing your local newspaper. You can still get the big news from the New York Times and they do a much better job a lot of the time. But that coverage of the local scene and the local world that you get, people going to your local school board, covering your governor, that you get with newspapers, you get that with the radio as well with your local music scene.
It's funny that
right. So K-Rock was really great. In fact, I think Carson Daly was on K-Rock.
Wait a second. Is K-Rock not K-Rock anymore? And that's K-Rock is K-R-O-Q here in Los Angeles. And I remember seeing U2 back in 2001. It was like November 2001. And Bono was on stage and they were coming out for their encore and they started, you know, the little riff to open whatever song they were about to sing. And it was one of their hits. And he talked about how it was amazing as a 20-year-old driving through the streets of Los Angeles with his bandmates, listening to KROQ as they played their song. And so, you know, there you had a radio station that was breaking groups like U2 that made Alanis Morissette's career. And now you're not going to have that. I mean, you might have it out of New York, but to break an artist now is going to be much more difficult, at least over radio. The question is, does anybody care? Is anybody still listening to radio?
No, they're not.
Well, clearly not. Clear Channel has about $20 billion in debt.
Oh, okay. Well, okay then. Yeah, I mean, I attended Blog World last week, and the one panel I attended was radio, is it dead, and are bloggers the new curators, hit makers for pop culture?
Yes.
And
yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable to me that this is the whole world has changed when it comes to trying to get music heard.
The times, they are changing. On the other hand,
and it's
Channel,
Spotify, it's Pandora, it's all of those online outlets. That is what, that's where people are going now.
Though Spotify seems to just reinforce the music you already listen to, and they don't seem to be pushing new artists so much as just whatever sounds.
Oh, no, but Spotify themselves aren't. But the whole idea for social music services is for people to say, you know, if you like this, then you like this, and people discover new music that way.
Music new to them, but they might send them to Creedence, Crosby, Stills, and Nash as much as it will to, say, Fleet Foxes.
Yeah, it might.
Yeah, which is okay. But, you know, if Clear Channel, however, if they're going to go national and they need a good entertainment show, I don't know.
Well, yeah, except they're talking about music mostly. Now, speaking of music, in a related note, Jim Ladd. Now, Karen, do you know who Jim Ladd is?
Any relation to Alan Ladd?
I don't believe so. And or Michael, do you know who he is?
Is he short like Alan Ladd?
Oh, geez, no. Okay, so he is a DJ in Los Angeles. But he's kind of like a legend among rock and roll stars because he helped bring, you know, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers to the public. I mean, he brought the 80s groups. He's been a DJ for 30-some-odd years, and they basically just called him up and said, guess what? You're no longer a DJ at KLOS.
Was he part of one of the Kills?
Yes, he was.
Oh, yeah, well.
And he didn't even get to do a farewell show. It was just, you know, see you later.
Rough.
That's very sad.
Yeah, well, is it as sad as my buying tickets for Funny Girl earlier this week to see at the Amundsen Theater here in Los Angeles before it heads off to New York? And why am I seeing it? Because Lauren Ambrose is going to star in it. And
Along with Bobby Cannavale.
And that's where I was headed. I was going to mention Bobby Cannavale. Those two kind of got me to buy the tickets. And it wasn't long, I had the tickets for maybe a day or two before I got an email saying that they would actually be refunding my money because they're not going to be doing Funny Girl at the Amundsen Theater or on Broadway.
That's a bummer.
Did you know about this, Michael? You must have known about this.
Did I know about it being scrapped?
Yes.
Sure, of course. It was big news here in New York. I mean, it meant that the Matthew Broderick musical called Nice Work If You Can Get It finally had a home. There's been a bunch of shows circling Broadway trying to find a home. And, you know, certain houses only work for certain shows. And Funny Girl stole that house, the Imperial, from the other shows that were hoping to get it. So as soon as Funny Girl sent their email out saying they were gone, I said, aha, Matthew Broderick got his house. And boom, the next day there was a notice saying, and now this show's going in there. So it's, you know, I think the big news is not that the show fell apart, but just that the financial backing fell apart. I think that seems to be the genuine truth about this.
Right. It's not that the, you know, somebody dropped out or that the, you know, wire work wasn't working or that, you know, they couldn't, Julie Taymor went wild on all of the sets. It was more just that he, and I should say, producer Bob Boyett, who's a kind of a well-known Broadway producer, and he's produced War Horse and South Pacific. He had four backers drop out of a $12 million production, and he couldn't find anybody to replace them.
They backed out in like the same week.
Yeah, all in the same week.
Why?
It's just financial times, you know? They just said, yeah, you know what? I don't really have any money.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, we don't really know, but that's just the gist of it.
Yeah, they're saying, well, we don't think it's the right time to bring Funny Girl to the stage. And oh, by the way, I'm broke. So,
and there are a lot of revivals coming to Broadway with Porgy and Bess coming that with Audra McDonald that got great reviews on the road. And Evita with Ricky Martin. That's a big buzz show from England. And Godspell's opening up tonight here in New York, which is not a huge show, but I think it's going to do pretty well with fans. So they just thought, it's a little overloaded with revivals. There are almost no new musicals, but there are a lot of revivals.
Kind of like movies. No new movies, but tons of remakes. You know, one of the things they talked about in the press about this story was that, well, maybe Lauren Ambrose wasn't a big enough draw to get people to the theater, and maybe that's why the investors backed out. And one of the things I found interesting was Boyett, the producer, said, well, we didn't even hold investor auditions. And
That's right. They'll say, hey, let us show you the show.
Yeah, that's where
you bring the investors into a room and let the stars schmooze with them and perform a couple numbers. And they go, wow, this sounds great.
This is going to be a great show. Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. You get them all hyped.
Disgusting.
No, not at all. It's perfectly normal. I mean, they have readings of work all the time. And, you know, it's a revival. Who's going to sing it? How are they going to be? What's it like? Especially with new musicals, they do it all the time. It's just at a reading on Friday. But for a revival, you want to say, hey, Lauren Ambrose, she's never been in a Broadway show before. Let her strut her stuff and let them say, okay, great. She's terrific. She's a star. It's what you do.
Now, the original production starred and kind of made Barbra Streisand's name. It built her reputation when she played Fanny Brice, the lead character in the musical. And then, of course, she won an Academy Award for the same role in 1968. And there was some talk about, well, the role is so legendary and Barbra Streisand in it is so, you know, that her version of that role is so legendary that nobody can fill those shoes. And so that's why Funny Girl has not been revived until now. And that's why, you know, they're canceling this new version.
Well, I was intrigued to see Lauren Ambrose in it. She's a good actress. I like her a lot. I don't know her as a singer per se. She's a good stage actress. You know, you kind of go, gee, okay, great. Can't wait to see if it works. But I think the one thing looming over this, and I don't think this is why it fell apart, but clearly the person everybody wants to see in Funny Girl is Lea Michele from Glee. That is the role she's meant to play. Everybody wants her to do that. They announced this revival before they had even picked a star, which is always ridiculous. A showcase show like this, you need to know what star you have before you make the show. You don't say, I want to do Funny Girl, and then look around to find an actress. You say, I want to do Funny Girl, or I want to do Pal Joey, and I want Hugh Jackman. Or I'm doing Funny Girl, and I want Lea Michele. You have to know who your star is, or there's no point in even trying to do a revival. So to, like, find Lauren Ambrose and see if she works doesn't really make sense, though I was enthusiastic about her. Lea Michele is meant to be in this show. Everybody wants to see her do it. She's performed numbers on Glee. She would sell tickets. They just have to wait a year or two until she's free from the television show and she can do it.
But do you think that her representation would let her do it, Karen? I mean, here she is already being compared to Barbra Streisand in so many ways. Do you think the agent and manager and publicist for Lea Michele would say, yeah, you should go do that role that made her famous?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you think so?
Absolutely. Because you know what? Lea Michele is not a movie star. And her career probably has peaked with Glee. So she's going to have to stick to her strengths, which is singing and being a diva. I think this really fits for her.
And Broadway.
Also,
I mean,
you know,
she's done a lot of Broadway.
Yeah, I mean, she'll get a Tony. And then she can, you know, start plotting, you know, going after, what is it called when you have a Tony and a Emmy?
Yeah,
the trifecta.
Tony's one of the hardest things to get, so.
Well, she starred in Spring Awakening. She starred in Fiddler on the Roof. She has a serious Broadway credential. She's a Broadway baby. She's going to live on Broadway for many years. And it's a role tailor-made for her. And she gets, you know, her ego is such a say, like, I'm going to make you forget Barbra Streisand. She'll chew it up and spit it out. But
she's so talented that if anybody can, I wouldn't surprise me if it was her.
What about Idina Menzel? Idina Menzel might be able to play that role.
She's too old.
She's too old for it.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Do you realize that I went to college with Idina Menzel and she was on my dorm, on the same floor as me when we were moved in as freshmen into the dorm? And now
you're saying
she's too old.
Well, you're not going to play a college student, are you? Well, you might actually get away with it.
Could totally get away with it.
Yeah, so I should change that. But no, Lea Michele's a Broadway star. She's going to be back on Broadway. It's a great vehicle for her. But I don't know if she's done necessarily. I mean, she could have pop albums in her career. I'm not sure whether she'll do a good or a bad one, but, you know.
No, but I guess what I mean is her acting career, I think, has
outside of the theater?
With Glee. No, yeah, outside of the theater.
Okay. Certainly not for Hugh Jackman, though. His theater career is burning up.
Yeah, no, actually, he kind of roadshowed this in San Francisco, but it's Hugh Jackman on Broadway, and it's in its first week of preview performances, and it made a small $1.2 million, which is a lot for a one-man show on Broadway.
It's a lot for any show on Broadway.
Well, I was going to revise that and say, you know, it's competing with Wicked and Book of Mormon. Those grosses are pretty big.
Right. This was something that you saw in an article in the Los Angeles Times, a blog item, which I think they were competing to see how many sort of confusing or inaccurate or conflicting things they could say in one small article.
You know, that tends to be I'm not going to knock the Times. I tend to like them, but I don't necessarily know that the person who was writing this was a Broadway aficionado.
Well, they sort of presented it as like a secret, like, oh, you know what? This is Hugh Jackman benefits from Broadway box office inflation. And they said, oh, he opened big, $1.2 million. But if you look at it, he's actually charging higher ticket prices than normal. And in fact, he does have really high ticket prices. But this is, in fact, as they go on to say, perfectly normal for Broadway. When you have a hit show and you want to see it on Thursday, Friday, or Saturday night, you're going to pay through the nose. You could pay, the ticket price might be $125. That's sort of standard. But if you want to see it on Friday night, great seats, it's $250 or $275 or $300 or $350.
Oh, who can afford that these days?
It says, well, we're in the world of Wall Street, and it's corporate people taking clients out to dinner. So, you know, dinner and a show, it happens all the time. But this is across the board. You know, Wicked, their top ticket price is $300. Spider-Man, $275. Book of Mormon, $475, because it's the hottest show on Broadway, and it's in a very small house.
Right. And also, it's kind of like, you know, not every seat in the theater is $475.
No. These are the premium seats. These are the absolute best in the orchestra, which they described as being on the aisle. But more typically, you'd be in the center.
Right. So, I compare it to airplane travel. You have everybody back in coach, and then they're paying, you know, a much lower amount than people in business class and first class, which are obviously overpaying for the seat. But you don't have that many seats. You don't have that many first class seats. You have, 10 people in first class.
That's right. So, it can be very hard to get a ticket to Book of Mormon, but if you're willing to pay up, you can get a ticket. You know, if you can pay even $300-$400 through the box office, you can buy a ticket. Or if you want to go through brokers, you can buy a ticket through there. But again, this is what everybody does. Every show that is successful charges more for premium seats on the weekend nights. The next thing that they said was that, well, it should be noted that Jackman's show is still in previews, a period during which productions tend to charge less than top prices because the staging is still being fine-tuned. That was true about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
People have not discounted previews because it's in previews for decades. They charge less a lot of times, or they're on TDF, which means you can get cheap tickets, because people don't want to go to the show. They don't know what it is yet. They don't know if it's good. So you will find shows like
TDF Venus is what? Ticket discount?
Yeah, it's a space on Broadway where you can get cheaper tickets to Broadway shows, 40% off, 50% off. And shows that are in previews will sometimes go there because audiences aren't in there yet. There are no reviews. They don't know if it's good. And they've got to get people in. So Venus in Fur, starring Nina Ariadne, or Seminar with Alan Rickman, Godspell. These are all shows that are in previews right now. So they charge less. Their average ticket price is $50, $60, $70, a lot less than Hugh Jackman, whose average price is $130.
So but, is it a big deal then or not? I mean, is it
part?
It's a big whoop. Of course he's making a lot of money. Everybody wants to see the show, and it's not a trick, and it's not a secret, and they got everything wrong.
Okay, well, since Karen is really looking forward to Big Deal or Big Whoop.
I always love Big Deal, Big Whoop.
That is our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story, have you done your Christmas shopping yet? Well, TV channels make their plans way in advance. You haven't even had a chance yet to judge the many TV folk hoping to pick up the audience left by Oprah Winfrey. Viewers will be sorting through people like Katie Couric and Jeff Probst of Survivor and Steve Harvey and Ricky Lake, but plans are already in the works for 2013 when Queen Latifah launches its show via Will Smith's production company. Latifah has a comedy about choir competition co-starring Dolly Parton coming out in January. I've seen it. It's not good. Plus, Latifah hosted...
Oh, it's disappointing. The trailer is fun.
The trailer is fun, and I was in the minority. People say, oh, it was fun. They'll love it in the heartland, and I'm thinking... This movie was trying to be Glee, and it was so bad. Anyway, Latifah hosted a talk show a few years back in 1999. She hosted it for 2 years. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop that she's launching a talk show. She's done it before, but I think it's a big deal for Will Smith. I mean, he's growing his empire. He's got a show on VH1 called Single Ladies. He's got a show on BET. He's got movies for his son, movies for his daughter, Karate Kid. He's got stuff on Broadway. This is his empire expanding and expanding. And for that reason, I think it's a big deal.
But does he have a show called All the Single Ladies? That's the show I want to see. Karen, what about you?
I agree. It's a big whoop. It would have been a huge deal if it was Will Smith doing a talk show. Wouldn't that be awesome?
Oh, that's kind of funny and interesting. He could have a different religion every week.
Nice.
After years of confusion and falling subscriptions, newspapers are finally seeing a little good news.
Yay.
And not even news that they're printing. Paywalls are leading to modest upticks in digital subscriptions and even print subscriptions that include digital access. Of course, this is happening with the name brand newspapers like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, not your small town papers. The Wall Street Journal has more than 500,000 paid digital subscribers, the most in the country. The New York Times has tripled its digital subscriptions to 380,000 since the paywall went up this past spring. Other papers with digital upticks include the LA Times, although I don't think they have a paywall, the Dallas Morning News, and the Denver Post. And the New York Times saw its print circulation rise for the first time in 5 years, mainly due to people buying the weekend or Sunday subscriptions, which include digital access. Big deal or big whoop, Karen?
This is a big deal. And, you know, it's they should never have offered any of this content for free in the very first place. And now, of course, there's no going back. So just the fact that it's going up actually is saying, well, maybe we can go back.
Yes. Well, over time, yes. And Michael, what do you think?
I think it's a big deal, too. It's good news. People want to pay for content that they value. It's going to work for the big name brands. It still doesn't help the small town newspaper.
EMI has a lot of toys, like songs and videos, and they want app developers to play with them. EMI is collaborating with the Echo Nest to create a site where app developers can access thousands of EMI-controlled songs, videos, and other music-related content. They hope people will come up with nifty apps that EMI can then release and everyone will be happy, including the music artists. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. Like, they want me to create apps for their artists and their songs? Gee, thanks.
What about you, Karen?
I'm sort of half and half. I mean, part of me does think, oh, it's a big whoop because for the exact reason that Michael said. But on the other hand, I do think it's interesting that people are kind of open sourcing people making apps. And really, everybody wins.
When being a full-fledged studio didn't work for DreamWorks, they decided to slim down and be distributed by Paramount. That's actually DreamWorks Animation. Since that relationship is about to end, DreamWorks Animation is thinking, why not distribute other people's movies? Jeffrey Katzenberg is kind of having a bad year, with analysts talking down his stock after Puss in Boots opened to the biggest numbers on Halloween weekend in history. Go figure. So is DreamWorks expanding after it has been contracting, or DreamWorks Animation expanding after it's been contracting, a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
I think it would have been a bigger deal had it been DreamWorks. The fact that it's DreamWorks Animation, to me, who's not a big cartoon lover, a big whoop.
Michael?
I mean, big whoop. I mean, they couldn't do it with their own movies. They had to go back to others. I don't understand the point of it at all. Who wants to go to them for distribution?
Well, yeah.
So DreamWorks.
DreamWorks Animation. And so my first thought was, well, what are they going to do? Just distribute other animated films that they didn't make? Or are they going to
distribute? Right, from indie people who aren't with major studios. It's so expensive to make an animated film. Who's out there with animated movies that needs a distributor?
Oh, a lot of people.
Yeah, actually, quite a few.
In fact, I think it'd be interesting if they actually took, you know, the nobodies out there who had stuff that they wanted to distribute. I mean, just lower
there are
the bar.
High quality feature length animation films that go begging.
They don't have to be feature length. Let's make them, you know, 45 minutes and you can tack two or three together.
Who is the top banana when it comes to launching a sequel of the hit film Rise of the Planet of the Apes? Is it the super hot James Franco? Is it super sexy Frida Pinto? No, it's Andy Serkis, who plays the ape Caesar in the film. Even though Caesar is crucial to the sequels more than any other character, Serkis was only signed for one film. He got a 7-figure payday and reassurances that they'll be pushing his performance for a Best Supporting Actor Oscar this year. Serkis is the motion capture superstar with roles in The Hobbit, Tintin, and Planet of the Apes, and now he's getting paid for it. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
It's a big deal. You know, it's really nice to see the non-name get the credit that he deserves. I mean, he actually means more to film geeks than James Franco, who I don't think is super hot, and Frida Pinto.
James Franco is good looking.
I think he's super hot, good looking, but I don't mean his career is super hot.
No. I just meant physically.
Yeah. Oh, no. I wouldn't kick him out of bed.
Okay. No. Andy Serkis, I agree with you completely. It's a big deal. That person who's behind this makeup can be recognized as important to the film creatively. And he's a draw for the geeks, like Karen says. I mean, he's a draw as Gollum in The Hobbit. So this is great news, I think. I think it's well-deserved. I mean, it's 7 figures. So he's getting like $1 million rather than, you know, the 5, 10, 8, 20 million big stars get. But hey, he might be the lead in the next movie or two. Maybe he can get more for the third.
Well, I'm just surprised that they only signed him to a one-picture deal, and now for the second picture, his agents were like, yeah, 7-figure payday now.
Yeah, I agree.
I guess they thought anybody can do it. We don't need him.
Talk about no foresight.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm glad that they're pushing him for Best Supporting Actor. I think he really deserves a nomination.
It could actually be a trend of nominating people who do mocap animation and mocap work. It'll be interesting to see what happens with that. Clash of the Titans 2 opens in March of 2012. Oh, why? But the studio behind it is already putting into motion work on Clash of the Titans 3. Is this genuine excitement about the film or just an attempt to goose the sequel's potential? It must be good. They're already making a third one. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. You know, it's not like they've greenlit it. They're just saying, oh, we're working on one. It's just to get you excited and think, oh, the second one must be really good. It's exactly what you say.
Karen?
A big whoop for the same reason, but the big deal to be found in here is the greed that is behind all this. I mean, the reason why they're making these, the two and possibly three, is because they do well overseas. No one cares whether it's a good movie or not. It's irrelevant.
Well, I mean, that's the business, isn't it? To make movies that make money?
Right. Greed, like I'm saying. I know. Oh, I know. Okay. You're right. And I am naive.
The group sing-alongs are a deadly moment in every American Idol show, and now they're proving a problem for the X Factor. Performer Leroy Bell was called out for clearly lip-syncing his part during the show's opening number recently, making clear what was already obvious to anyone paying the slightest attention or anyone with a pulse. The show defended it two ways. One, Idol does this as well. And two, hey, superstars do it during their shows when facing a lot of choreography, so it's a skill he needs to demonstrate. Big deal or big whoop? Karen.
Yeah, it's actually a big deal.
Okay.
This is a major screw up.
And Michael, what do you think?
I think it's a big whoop. We knew they were lip syncing. They do it always on Idol. It's hard to get everybody to rehearse together for the group numbers. I don't think they should do them for that very same reason. It looks silly for them to lip sync on a live performance show. But I do love their argument that, hey, superstars have to lip sync. It's like, great, have a segment where they compete at being really good at lip syncing. Don't pretend that they're performing live when they are lip syncing. And this just goes on top of the problem that they had with using auto-tune in the UK version, which Simon Cowell swore they would never do here. All right, if you're not going to use auto-tune, why are you using lip-syncing?
Well, I mean, one of the things they were saying is, look, they sing to a backing track, and that's what you were hearing. And that happens quite often. I mean, even...
That's got nothing to do with their vocals being live. People sing to backing tracks all the time. They tour with backing tracks. It doesn't mean you can't sing live.
No, I mean, the Swedish pop star Robin wouldn't exist if it weren't for a backing track. Exactly. And I like her. I'm saying, you know, because, you know, she basically overdubs herself. And the only way to do that live is to sing to a backing track.
Exactly.
I have to confess, I didn't know that they lip synced. Sync?
Oh, they lip sync on Idol all the time for the group performances because there's a lot of choreography and it's hard to get everybody together and it's hard to mic them together and to do a good job. And they also want to rehearse, focus on their own performances or their own numbers. So they just get everybody together, do a recording of the song, and then they're done. So they have to keep practicing it and working with it together. So it's sort of done and put aside so they don't have to freak out about it.
So Karen, they lip sync on Idol and they studios make movies for money.
And there's no Easter Bunny.
No Easter Bunny.
No Easter Bunny?
I say again, the group on X Factor is very strong. It's well worth checking out.
Director Terrence Malick is making two films back-to-back with numerous name-brand actors appearing in both works. Okay, take a moment to peek at the calendar. No, it's not April Fool's Day. Malick, a director famous for taking, what, decades to actually make a film, is actually going to make two films in the same year, starring folks like Ryan Gosling and Cate Blanchett. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It blows my mind. It took him 20 years to go from his second to his third film. Then I think it was 7 years between The Thin Red Line and The New World, and then 6 years between that and Tree of Life. Now he's filming two movies back to back. It's like he's lost his mind. It's unbelievable. And, you know, I thought Tree of Life was great, so I'm intrigued and fascinated, but it seems like a joke.
As you know, I'm not a big Terrence Malick fan. What do you think, Karen?
I was going to say the exact same thing. I was going to say, big whoop, an overrated director makes a movie. Whee!
Well, yeah. New Age author Deepak Chopra has been signed by Amazon. The internet website continues its push toward publishing by signing Chopra and his brother for a memoir about their lives. Chopra has always had multiple publishers throughout his career, but his main focus is with Crown, which has just launched a Deepak Chopra imprint to release his books and other titles he brings in, making this all the more remarkable and I'd like to say strange. Big deal or big whoop, Karen?
Amazon signed this major best-selling author for their imprint.
big whoop.
No,
I'm still trying to wrap my brain around why it would not be.
Because Amazon, it was not a publisher. They're a bookstore, and now they're pushing into publishing very strongly. They signed Penny Marshall's memoir. They beat out a bunch of major publishers and paid her millions of dollars to get Penny Marshall's biography. Now they're signing
Deepak. Wrapping my head around it. I see what you're saying. It is a big deal. But, yeah, you know, they're doing like what Google is like doing, you know? They're like moving into an area that they're not known for. So they're either going to really screw up or they're going to look like geniuses.
Well, they sell books, so it's not that much of a stretch.
They sell a hell of a lot more than books.
They sell toilet paper, for Pete's sake.
Amazon's a storefront. That's how they made money.
Yeah.
Not by selling books, but by being a storefront.
Amazon still doesn't make money, actually.
they are profitable.
I thought they were always pushing forward. They were always saying, don't worry, we'll be profitable in the future.
No. God, that was like the first four or five years of their existence. But they are definitely profitable now. They're becoming less profitable because they're spending money on other things. But they are profitable.
Well, this is a big push into publishing. They've got, you know, Karen, don't forget, they've got the Kindle, which is the number one way for people to read ebooks. Moving into.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Who'd be bigger? Nobody. I mean, the iPad is just starting. Kindle has been around for quite a few years, so Kindle is still by far the biggest. They dominate ebook sales. Now they're going to be signing up authors and publishing, you know, not just new names like they've been doing. They can let anybody can post a book on Amazon and sell their ebook, but now they're pushing and competing with other publishers for name brand authors. I think it's a very big deal. And it's bizarre. It's such an FU to Crown. I mean, they just gave him his own imprint.
That's what's really odd. You know, you'd think the Crown would say, oh, yeah, well, screw you. We're dropping you.
But
yeah, that's where I got tripped up.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of shocking. Now, of course, we could have also put in the story about how Amazon is allowing its Kindle users to borrow books.
They've been working with libraries for a while to help libraries be able to let people borrow books from libraries via Kindle, which they're working on and doing. And this is a separate thing where they're just saying, hey, if you're a Prime Amazon Prime subscriber, we got a couple thousand books here. If you want to borrow them for a limited amount of time, you can.
Right.
That's
now
kind
I
of
have
amazing.
To figure out how to do that because I'm an Amazon Prime Now I have to figure out where that is.
No, well, you need one of the devices. You need a Kindle. You can't just do it through their software.
Why can't I download the Kindle app on my iPad?
Because they're trying to let the publishers know, look, we're not just going to go willy-nilly with this. We're not going to spread this, you know, everywhere. Just people who have purchased a Kindle and happen to be Amazon Prime members can get, they can borrow books from certain publishers.
And it's them moving towards the Netflix model of having a library of books available for a fee.
Right.
Which seems like the future for a lot of books.
No, right. Willy-nilly?
Willy-nilly. I couldn't think of another word. Well, you know, speaking of the future and speaking of trying to wrap our heads around the publishing industry, that's kind of our topic for Inside Baseball this week.
Goodbye, and, big deal, big whoop.
Goodbye, yes. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, back in, maybe it was August, this summer, certainly, Sirius XM, which is a satellite radio provider here in the U.S., I don't think they're in Canada, but they are in the U.S., they said that they wanted to start making direct licensing deals with labels. Now, what does that mean exactly?
Please tell us.
Well, that means that rather than paying SoundExchange, which is how right now radio stations, they'll pay SoundExchange for all of the music rights that they play, you know, that they broadcast. That's what Sirius XM does. They don't go and cut a deal with every single individual label that they want to play music of. They just go and pay a flat fee to SoundExchange. SoundExchange then pays 50% to the label or the copyright owner, which is usually a label. They pay 45% to the featured performer, and then they pay another 5% to, I guess, those performers that aren't featured. So, you know, basically the non-writer usually.
So it's a clearinghouse instead of having to go to every single, getting checks or things from every single record label or radio station or whoever's paying you, you get it through one thing, just like ASCAP or BMI or some other people might be clearinghouses for actors or songwriters.
That's right. That's right. Now, I've always complained that there is nothing like this for movies. And that's why Netflix has gotten into a lot of trouble because they do have to make direct deals. There is no, you know, sound exchange for movies. But, you know, Pandora, Spotify, RDO, Mog, they too have to make direct deals with labels because they don't fit into this whole sound exchange model.
Well, if a lot of other people do it, like Pandora and Spotify, why are people upset that Sirius wants to do it as well? if Sirius wants to make these direct deals, why is this such a horrible thing as compared to all the other people that do it?
Well, a couple reasons, actually. First, payments to performers are made directly and simultaneously when you go through Sound Exchange. And what the SiriusXM idea would be is that artists will no longer be paid directly and simultaneously as the label. Instead, they will be that money will be given to the label. The label will then have that money and it will pass through them. The question is, what's going to come out of that check when it's sent off to the artist?
Well, presumably it would be done in a way that the artist wouldn't lose money. There's no reason why they'd agree to a deal in which they would be owed $10 but only get $9.
Well, yeah, but, you know...
But that's been happening to artists for
exactly.
Ever.
Yeah, I mean, the history of record companies kind of...
No, but I'm saying the artist won't agree to a deal in which they're going to have another middle... I mean, the middleman is either Sound Exchange or the label, so there's already a middleman there. And I know there's been a lot of complaints about Sound Exchange and that they have a lot of money that they sit on that they don't distribute. They can't find out who's owed that money. So, like, Sirius plays a song, pennies are put aside to go to the songwriter or musician or artist, whoever deserves money, and then Sound Exchange doesn't find and track down who deserves that money. And so they sit on an ever-growing pile of money that doesn't get distributed.
Right.
One of the complaints about Sound Exchange. So they're a middleman, just like the record label.
But they're also transparent. They basically say, you want to come and audit our books? Here they are. If you can find some of these people, we're more than happy to pay them. We have the money for them.
Okay.
And right now, I mean, if you're an artist, can you, as an artist, go and audit your label? It's very hard. You can if you're if you're the Rolling Stones, you can audit your label. But you can't if you're, Fiona Apple, you're not going to audit the label because, you don't have enough money. So
is there anything good about this?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I'm still trying to figure out, it's good if you're SiriusXM. I mean, right now, and here's the copyright that they play under. They play under this rate that was set by the Copyright Royalty Board with input from, the federal government and radio stations and Sound Exchange, and they currently pay 7.5% of their gross revenue. So that's what SiriusXM pays, 7.5% of all their gross revenue.
That gets set aside and distributed to creative artists.
That gets sent to Sound Exchange, and then Sound Exchange divvies it up the way they're supposed to. Now, that copyright ends, and that license ends in 2012. And, of course, it would have to be renegotiated. And what SiriusXM is saying is, well, we'd like to do it directly with the labels. Why? Because they'll pay less. Instead of 7.5%, maybe they'll pay 6.5% or 6%. Well, of course, that means that the artists themselves would get less.
So who has to sign off on this, the labels or the artists?
That's a good question. I guess it's technically the copyright holders.
Well, Sirius is in Canada, so I'm sure Canadian subscribers are happy to hear Sirius. They even have a channel about Made in Canada where they celebrate Canadian artists.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's right. They do, actually. You're right. And they have a Montreal French Canadian station.
What does this mean to people who listen to satellite radio? Does this mean anything to the fans?
Not a bit, I don't think. I mean, what it really means is, it means something to those artists who are trying to get paid. Because ultimately, what Billboard magazine is suggesting, and I'm quoting here, the question arises, the labels will pay the artist half the royalty, or 50%, as they're paid now by Sound Exchange, or will they pay, or will some labels choose to pay them their artist? Wow.
When the labels pay an artist a royalty rate, it's usually like 15 or 20%, but when it's sent, but when they get the amount of money that they get from Sirius for their song play is 50%. So the labels might say, all right, well, you get 20% of that rate, even though, well, hey, I used to get $5. Now I'm only getting $2.50 or $2. What the heck's going on?
Right. And ultimately what this is trying to do is it's trying to turn SiriusXM. They want the same licensing agreements as Rhapsody, Mog, or Spotify, or Pandora. Why? Because those groups pay pennies, fractions of pennies, to play a song. Whereas,
and why?
Because that's the licensing deal that was struck.
Why aren't people angry at Rhapsody and Spotify and Mog and all them?
They are. They're very angry because when they actually figured out, hey, wait a second, my song has to be played 4 million times for me to make $5.
Well, artists are not allowing their songs to be played on these.
That's right.
Yeah, so when those contracts come up, that'll be a big fight as well.
I think you're probably right about that. Much like it was, once everybody realized Netflix could actually make money, all of a sudden
they want a lot more money.
They want a lot more money.
Right. Yeah, so the big thing for fans, like a cute little startup.
Yeah, exactly.
The big thing for the fans is, you know, songs may disappear for a while on this service or that service while contracts get renegotiated. Just like Fox almost came off of Comcast's cable channels when they had that re-upping argument a few weeks ago.
Retransmission, yeah. Now, part of the reason for that copyright royalty board is that you don't have to go and negotiate with every single record label. And if you want to play a song from some obscure label, fine, play it, and it'll get recorded, and then you'll pay your fee, and that's that. And Sound Exchange will do all the work. You know, if you basically turned SiriusXM into the same thing as Spotify, then you will have those gaps. You know, we'd love to play the Rolling Stones for you, but we can't because we don't have a license with them.
So it's not that we want Sirius to succeed, but we want Pandora and Spotify to fail and have to sort of pay up bigger bucks for the songs that they get to play.
We don't want anybody to fail. Let's not start that rumor.
In contract negotiations. If they're being unfair, we do.
Well, right now,
we support the artists.
Right now, Rhapsody, Moog, Spotify, the reason they were given such sweetheart deals is because they could never afford. Yeah, it's a new business. They could never afford to pay what radio was paying. So that's why. So as they are capable of paying more, I'm sure they will wind up paying more. All of those internet services.
Yeah, because there was a time when you'd be on an internet website radio thing and you'd play four songs and they'd be charging you amounts that were crazily out of whack with who the audience was and how many people you reached.
Right. Now, we should probably move on to some of our listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Before we do, I'd like to thank Gary Webster for a 5-star review on iTunes. And Eddie Ginsberg for a 4-star review. And, you know, we keep getting emails asking us, when are we going to do video? When are we going to do video? And
they haven't seen my photo, obviously.
You know, let's, you know, never say never. Let's just put it that way. Now, I guess maybe I'll read this first one. And we got a lot of email about how to pronounce Tintin in French. Ralph Silva said that in French, it isn't pronounced Tintin or Tonton. It is closer to Tintin with the N nasally and partially swallowed.
That's right. I went to a YouTube
video. You must do that, one of you.
What?
Pardon?
Say it in say it properly
Tintin.
In French.
Tintin.
Tintin. Tintin.
I went to find the trailer in French, and at the very end it says, "Je m'appelle Tintin."
Really?
So it was sort of Tintin. I'm trying to swallow the N. It's not easy.
Do you want to read the comment that CJ Flynn wrote on our post from last week?
Oh, that was very nice of CJ to write back. It said, "Break out the old Selectric with the correcting ribbon. I type humbled. Watching the Tintin preview, I hear that he introduces himself as Tintin, not Tintin or Tintin. I didn't know. I chastised you previously. I will never be so bold again. Notwithstanding, here in the EU, the name is pronounced as if it were spelt Tintin. I will say no more about it. I noticed this in today's paper and sent the typically unnuanced translation. The French media often talk in admissions, not income, by the way. And as you probably both know, France has the most screens of any market in the EU." Okay. Well, appreciate
that. I guess what he did here was he had a link that if you click on it, you can. That's a completely separate topic other than the Tintin, Tintin, Tonton.
I beg your pardon. Yes, as we saw in France, they had one of the biggest openings in the world just from the French market alone. The Intouchables opened at 12.5 million, which is a huge amount of money. It's a big market.
Yeah, it's huge, as is Germany. And in Belgium, The Adventures of Tintin set a record for, you know, an opening in Belgium, which would make sense.
As one would hope.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. Now, if you want to write to us, again, the email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us. The number to call, toll-free, is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. If you want to subscribe to the show and maybe rate us in, say, iTunes, the way Gary Webster and Eddie Ginsberg did, please feel free. iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, or Stitcher. Stitcher can be found at stitcher.com. Links to those sites, as well as links to all of the stories we talked about on today's episode, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to follow us. We have a Twitter account. That's twitter.com/showbizsandbox. And we're on Facebook under the name Showbiz Sandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt. Now, I also think they're going to be this week at the Guggenheim Museum in New York, so look that up. Karen, where can you be found?
At KarenWoodwardOnline.com and on Twitter at Karen_Woodward.
and in our hearts.
Yes.
Oh, I miss you guys.
Now, Michael, you can be found where?
Oh, my God. MichaelGiltz.com. You can find a lot of my stuff on Huffington Post. You can just search for my name. You'll find everything there. I'm on Twitter. What is my Twitter name? Michael Giltz.
Yes, Michael Giltz. I'm on Twitter. My Twitter username is Sperling. You can find some of my writing at CelluloidJunkie.com. And until next week, play nice.
Au revoir.
Aw, that was fun, you guys. I miss you.
Not as much as we miss you.
Yes. Oh, no.